Welcome to this week's colloquium. Today we're pleased to have Joe Bassin. He got his PhD in Oxford and then did postdocs at Brookhaven National Lab, Princeton, and Cambridge before ending up where he is currently in King's College London. Today he's going to tell us about the relationship between black holes and quantum transport.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks in particular to Rob Myers for the invitation to talk here. So this is some work that I've done over the last few years in collaboration with a combination of different people ranging from string theorists to cosmologists to condensed matter physicists. So Benjamin Doyon, for example, is one of my colleagues in King's, who's an expert in integrable models. Conrad Charm is a string theorist working in Leiden. Andy Lucas is a fantastic graduate student of Subir Sachdev at Harvard, who's working on hydrodynamics and condensed matter systems. Ben is an expert in condensed matter theory. Julian and Jerome are string theorists, and Toby Wiseman is an expert in numerical general relativity and is a former PhD student of Neil Turok. And I should also thank some local enthusiasts as well. So a lot of this work has been done in collaboration and in discussions with experts in different fields of various conferences, and in particular, Robert, William, and Mikkel, and Alex, I'd met at different European conferences before coming to the Perimeter Institute, and they were always very keen to share their ideas and their understanding and the possibility that some of the ideas emerging in ADS-CFT could be relevant to condensed matter. And if you look at some of their recent work, it ranges from kind of non-equilibrium dynamics through to quantum quenches, through to thermalization and entanglement measures. Okay, all of these topics are of very great interest in the condensed matter literature. And what I'm going to try and convince you of is that there's some very strong quantitative links between these different subjects. Okay, so in particular, in the Perimeter Institute, you obviously have a lot of expertise in a variety of different subjects, ranging from aspects of quantum information through to cosmology, through to condensed matter physics. And what I'm going to try and show is that not only are there some kind of strong analogies between these disciplines, actually there's some real quantitative links. Okay. And so the way I'm going to try and demonstrate this is to take some simple examples coming out of the ADS-CFT literature and show you how to make contact with these things in the condensed matter literature. Okay. So I think also King's was quite excited about this. So this is an advert from a recent postgraduate research open day, and they accidentally renamed our group from theory and simulation of condensed matter to theory and simulation of dark matter. So I think they're expecting this to turn out to be productive. Okay. So the outline of the talk is I'll give you some kind of motivation from a condensed matter perspective for why I'm particularly interested in these applications of ADS-CFT. I'll give a little bit of a kind of brief overview of what this gauge gravity duality or ADS-CFT is about. And in particular, to try and explain why it's particularly useful for looking at far from equilibrium problems. And so in order to do this, I'll focus on this recent work looking at energy flow between different quantum critical systems. And the reason for doing this is that you can study this problem within purely Einstein gravity. So nothing more than general relativity that you learn about in all of your textbooks. And I'm going to try and link this to results coming out of the condensed matter literature in low dimensions. So, as I said, I'm a condensed matter theorist, and what are most condensed matter theorists in? They're interested in interesting states of matter, and one of the kind of driving forces of a lot of condensed matter over the last few years has been superconductivity, okay? So here, just showing the transition to superconductivity in mercury, and you see at very low temperatures, mercury just completely loses all of its electrical resistance, and the holy grail is to make materials that superconduct at room temperature. Okay, clearly, if you could do that, you would transform all sorts of different technological applications. But so far, we've not been able to do that. Okay, so part of the difficulty is, although we understand conventional types of superconductivity, high-temperature superconductivity still holds some secrets. Okay, so there's been a lot of progress over the last 20 or 30 years, but still there's many challenges to face. So The reason I'm showing you this is what it shows is that this is an example of a phase transition, okay? It's not a structural phase transition. It's a phase transition going on inside of this material. The electrons are completely reorganizing themselves to form Cooper pairs. And as a result of that transformation, this material can conduct electricity without any dissipation, okay? And so a much more kind of modern way of thinking about such problems is that, you know, in just a few grams of any material, you've got of order 10 to the 23 particles. And if these particles are all interacting with each other, it's clear that there's a lot of scope for interesting emergent behavior, okay? And in particular, even if you knew the precise laws governing the interactions between those particles, predicting the emergent behavior might actually be very complicated, okay? And we've just discussed an example of Cooper pairs, but if you look, for example, in the quantum Hall effect, you can see that not only is it possible to kind of glue electrons together to make pairs, you can actually make excitations that have fractions of the charge of the electron. So you're not splitting the electron, but the emergent excitations are very, very different than the carriers themselves. And in fact, in a lot of examples, the interactions between the particles are so strong that you don't even have a quasi-particle description. And so then the big question is, how do you describe such states of matter where the emergent degrees of freedom are incredibly different than the microscopic particles that your material is made from? And so broadly speaking, this kind of line of research goes under the name of strongly correlated systems. And what we're interested in is techniques that can help us to shed light on such strongly correlated problems. Okay. So as a condensed matter theorist, how might you go about getting some insights into strongly correlated systems? Typically, what you do is you write down some simple model, some simple Hamiltonian, okay? So this is a very famous model known as the Bose-Hubbard model. It was recently realized maybe 10 years ago in ultra-cold atomic gases, and it describes some bosons hopping on a square lattice. So this is nearest neighbor hopping. There's some repulsive interactions between the bosons, and there's some chemical potential to change the number of bosons in your system. And so this has a very nice and well-understood phase diagram. It consists of these Mott-insulating lobes. These are lobes where you have just an integer number of bosons per site. And the idea is that if these bosons are repelling each other, they're essentially gridlocked, and they form an insulator. Okay, so in contrast to conventional insulators, which you normally think about as filling bands, these materials are insulating by virtue of strong interactions, okay? So they're completely gridlocked. So what's known is that if you crank up the hopping in this problem, this system undergoes a transition from a Mott insulator to a superfluid. The bosons can hop around through the lattice and exhibit superfluid properties, and this has been seen now experimentally in very clean realizations of this system. But what I want to just try and emphasize for the purposes of this talk is that quite a lot is known about the phase transition between this Mott insulator and this superfluid. So in particular, if you go along this central line, it turns out that the energy cost to either adding or subtracting a particle is the same. And whenever particles and holes appear on an equal footing, you normally start to think about relativistic systems. And in particular, if you ask what's the field theory that describes this transition, it's a field theory, a relativistic field theory that's in all of the standard textbooks on quantum field theory. It's Landified to the fourth. It's a theory of a scalar field, a charged scalar field, describing particle and hole excitations above this Mott insulator. So you imagine the system is completely gridlocked. You can add a particle, remove a particle, and these excitations are described by this scalar field theory. So if you look in your standard textbooks on quantum field theory, they'll compute all sorts of properties for this system, such as critical exponents, and do all sorts of fancy things based on the so-called epsilon expansion. What you're interested in is you're interested in systems that display strong quantum effects. So typically, you're interested in looking at these systems in reduced dimensionality. So what you normally do is what's called an epsilon expansion below the upper critical dimension, where you can try to take into account systematically the role of fluctuations. So in particular, this was looked at in relation to transport properties. Okay, we're interested in this kind of system of interacting bosons. They're potentially mobile and they can move around. And so rather than thinking about critical indices, it's much more natural to start thinking about transport properties in this context. And so there was a very nice work done by Subir Sachdev and his PhD student at the time, Kedar Damler, where what they demonstrated is you could compute the AC conductivity at this quantum phase transition, this phase transition between this Mott insulator and this superfluid. And so what they found was that this conductivity is a universal function of omega over T, okay? The temperature is the only scale in the problem if you're close to this quantum phase transition, as it's called, okay? It's called a quantum phase transition because we're not imagining changing the temperature to turn this thing from a Mott insulator to a superfluid. We're changing the interactions between the particles, which you could imagine doing at zero temperature. And so what we're doing is we're now heating up the sample a little bit and asking how does the response depend on temperature? But then it's clear that the only scale in that problem is temperature. Okay, you've gone to this phase transition, any excitation gap has closed at that transition, and so what you expect is that all of your response functions should be some scaling function of frequency over temperature. And in particular, what they demonstrated is that if you look at the DC response, it's some universal number times 4e squared upon h. Okay, so this is a unit of conductance, it's a fundamental unit that appears, for example, in the quantum Hall effect. And so what they're saying is you can start to shed light on the universal transport properties at this transition, okay? And this was very close to the experimental value seen in thin film superconductors. It's actually a little bit difficult to get very precise experimental data because you've got to sit very close to the transition. So you shouldn't necessarily take that coincidence as kind of strong evidence in favor of this. But nonetheless, there's experimental observations that the conductivity is probably in this ballpark of some multiple of 4e squared upon h. And the factor of four comes from the fact that essentially they're looking at a problem of bosons, which you can think of being Cooper pairs, so they carry charge 2e, okay? So this is an example of a universal result for transport. And what it also shows is that you have some kind of transition, some crossover, between what you can think of as being a collisionless regime and a collision-dominated regime. So at very high frequencies, you're probing the system on very short timescales. Your system doesn't have time to experience the interactions, and so you're in a collisionless regime. Whereas at very low frequencies, when you examine the DC response, you're very susceptible to the strong interactions in this system. Okay? So it exhibits a crossover between hydrodynamic or collision-dominated behavior and collisionless behavior. So the reason for kind of mentioning this example is that one of the problems we looked at after this work, quite a long time actually after this work, was that the fact that you can also compute other transport properties in this system. You can, for example, not only apply electric fields and look at electrical response, you can look at behavior of thermal transport, you can apply magnetic fields, for example, and look at the full set of thermoelectric response coefficients. And in particular, if you look at this result for the thermal conductivity in a magnetic field, it has a rather strange dependence. It actually goes inversely with this parameter epsilon that controls how far you are away from this upper critical dimension. So typically, we're interested in results in two dimensions, so you can imagine at least to lowest order, just setting epsilon equals to one. You see that somehow these results are reciprocally related. And so what was very interesting is very shortly after this work, Subir Sachdev and Marcus Muller, who are both condensed matter physicists, published a very beautiful paper with Sean Hartnell, who's a string theorist, and Pavel Kovtun, who's an expert in hydrodynamics, demonstrating that you could compute all of these response functions from a combination of hydrodynamics and supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. Okay? So what I described in the first part of the talk was this Bose-Hubbard model, a transition in a standard XY universality class. And the claim is that you could compute all of these transport coefficients by looking at a supersymmetric gauge theory. Okay? This is far from obvious as a condensed matter physicist that this should have any bearing whatsoever on the universality class that you're interested in. Okay? Now, what they demonstrated was that actually, all of these transport coefficients could be related to this DC conductivity. And so instead of there being a kind of plethora of different transport coefficients, in a sense, there was just one transport coefficient, the DC conductivity, and all of the other transport coefficients were slaves to this, and they were dressed by thermodynamic quantities such as the entropy density or temperature. Okay? So the value of this DC conductivity, that depends on the universality class. That will differ between the XY universality class and Yang-Mills theory, but the relationship between all of these coefficients is the same in these two distinct universality classes. And what they demonstrated was that this is actually a consequence of hydrodynamics. And so, in a sense, there's something super universal about this approach, okay? There's the ability not only to understand complicated problems of universality classes you're interested in, but it's possible for systems in different universality classes to exhibit similar behavior because they're essentially in some strongly interacting regime governed by hydrodynamics. And so what I want to try and do in this talk is to demonstrate that actually you don't have to look at supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory to see that there's a very strong and robust dictionary between things that you're interested in a condensed matter context and things that are being developed in the high-energy community. Okay? And I should point out, in our original work, this number differed by maybe 1% from this prediction that comes from looking at these supersymmetric gauge theories. And after this work, we went back to examine the calculation that was done within the Boltzmann framework, Boltzmann equation, very complicated integral differential equation. And actually, it's a little bit subtle how you get the correct leading order response. And so what we managed to demonstrate was that actually you could reproduce this result via using traditional techniques from the condensed matter side, okay? So there's genuinely a dialogue to be had between these different techniques. Okay, so what is this gauge gravity duality about? Well, what it's saying is that, you know, you're interested in, as a condensed matter theorist, some system, let's say it's close to some quantum phase transition, it's made of your microscopic particles in the lab, and the idea is that such theories could be dual to a theory in one higher space-time dimension that might actually be derived from an even higher dimensional theory, such as string theory, okay? So again, it's not immediately obvious that if you start with some string theory and you compactify it down to, let's say, five dimensions, and then you look at the four-dimensional boundary of such a theory, that actually this could describe something that you might be physically interested in. But what I'm going to try and argue is that that is very much the case, and it's partly because some of these strongly interacting systems share common features. Okay? So another way to think about this is that, you know, it's some kind of strong-weak duality. Okay, you map this theory, this strongly interacting quantum system or strongly interacting gauge theory into a weakly coupled classical theory of gravity in one higher dimension. And finite temperature in this theory is played by the presence of black holes in your gravitational description, okay? And so one of the things I'll try and comment on a little bit is that actually, in some sense, the kind of properties of these black holes have an impact on the dynamics of your boundary theory. And so some knowledge of the gravitational description might give us some kind of organizing framework to understand the complex behavior of these interacting quantum systems, okay? Another way to also look at this from a slightly more philosophical perspective is that you know that if you have some strongly interacting quantum system where the degrees of freedom are very different than your microscopic constituents, it's not unreasonable that you might need a different way of looking at the problem. So I agree that, you know, a condensed matter physicist is not necessarily going to think that gravity in one higher dimension is going to be the correct way to think about their physical problem in the lab. But nonetheless, it's clear that you need a slightly different language to understand the emergent excitations in some of these systems. Okay. So what is this ADS-CFT correspondence about? I'm not going to go into all the technical details, primarily because there's probably people that are actually much more competent in the audience and string theorists that could actually do a much better job in this respect. That's not the main goal of the talk. So what I want to do is just kind of sketch how the main aspects of the correspondence come about and what we're interested in. So as a condensed matter physicist, what you're interested in is the partition function, say, or the generating function for correlation functions in your lab. So this is going to be the boundary of some higher dimensional space-time, and this extra dimension is normally parameterized by some coordinate z. And the idea is that there's a relationship between the partition function that you're interested in and a classical theory of gravity that lives in this higher dimensional space-time. So this is enshrined in the so-called Gubser-Klebanov-Polyakov-Witten formula, and what it's saying is this there's a relationship between the exponential of some classical action that lives in this higher dimensional space-time that is acting as a generating function for observables in your boundary theory. And so the question as a condensed matter physicist is, how far can you push that correspondence, and can we actually use it to learn something about the behavior of these boundary theories that we might have difficulty doing directly? Okay? I should say that one difficulty with this approach from a condensed matter perspective is that very often the way the procedure works is that you start now from this gravitational side, that defines your model, this is a so-called bottom-up approach, and you turn the machinery of this holographic dictionary to understand what happens on the boundary. But as a condensed matter physicist, normally what you're interested in is you know what the Hamiltonian of your boundary system is, and you would rather have a direct approach to understand and compute observables. So this makes it a little bit difficult to translate what's computed on the holographic side into condensed matter language. But what I'm going to try and convince you of is that if you ask questions that are sufficiently universal, then actually not knowing what the boundary theory is, even if you can compute it, is actually less relevant, okay? That some of these models actually share very similar properties, and in fact you could start from many different gravitational theories on this side and still get similar behavior on the boundary, okay? So that's what I'm going to be interested in, universal results that really don't care whether I'm dealing with supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory or the Bose-Hubbard model. So just to flesh out a little bit more about this correspondence, the way this dictionary works is that you have fields living in this higher dimensional space-time that depend on this parameter Z, and these fields have an expansion close to the boundary. And the idea is that the coefficients in this expansion relate to physical observables in your boundary theory. So to give you an example, if you were to introduce a gauge field into this higher dimensional gravitational dictionary, the time component has an expansion close to this boundary, which is mu minus rho z, where mu is the chemical potential and rho is the expectation value of the corresponding charge. He says that if you're a condensed matter physicist and you're interested in a problem of charge transport, the natural thing to do holographically is to introduce some gauge field into this higher dimensional space-time and to try and read off the chemical potential and the charge density using this dictionary. Okay, so there's a field operator correspondence. Okay, so over the last few years, there's been kind of a huge amount of activity on what's become known as ADS-CMT. So this relationship between this space-time with constant negative curvature, anti de Sitter space-time, and condensed matter theory. And what they're trying to do is to compute things like transport coefficients in order to try and understand experiments on strongly correlated systems. Okay, so one of the holy grails that is still not understood is high-temperature superconductivity. They have many anomalous properties. In particular, the metallic behavior above the superconductor has some very unusual features. So people have been trying to use these techniques to understand what are called strange metals, to try and understand strongly correlated fermionic problems. The other thing that people have been trying to do is to generate holographic jewels of models we understand in condensed matter physics. And there are some examples of this, but it's a little bit harder, for the reasons I explained at the outset, to sometimes generate explicit boundary Hamiltonians to say, this is precisely what I have in the lab. Okay? So for the purposes of this talk, I'm not going to approach the problem from that perspective. I'm not going to insist that string theorists and people working in ADS-CFT generate precisely the Hamiltonians that we might be interested in condensed matter. Okay, so most of that kind of activity is in relation to equilibrium problems, looking at linear response transport coefficients. But actually, what I'm going to try and explain is that ADS-CFT is very useful for looking at problems far from equilibrium. And if you think about the amount of progress we've made over the last 100 years or so in looking at equilibrium statistical mechanics, what's lacking is an organizing framework to understand problems out of equilibrium. Every time you drive a system far from equilibrium, it's somehow like dealing with a brand new problem every single time. And so somehow, there's a lack of organizing principles out of equilibrium. And so one hope is that this ADS-CFT correspondence might be able to help us in that regard. Okay. So why might this actually be useful? Well, it's useful from a couple of different perspectives. One is that what it's saying is we can reformulate the quantum dynamics of this interacting quantum system in a completely different way. It's encoded in the solution of the classical Einstein equations in one dimension higher. So as a condensed matter physicist, that's already very interesting because it says that you have this complicated quantum problem that you're interested in, but somehow it's telling you that you should look instead at a classical problem in one dimension higher. So as long as you can solve the corresponding Einstein equations, you might at least have a hope to start to get some insights into these difficult problems. The other aspect that's very interesting about the reformulation is that finite temperature on your boundary theory gets encoded into the Hawking temperature of a black hole. So what that means is that the Einstein equations are real-time partial differential equations. He says that if you want to understand properties at finite temperature, you don't have to do any of these usual procedures of going to imaginary time and Wick rotating. Your formulation is already tailor-made to work at finite temperature, but in real time. So it means it's very good for looking at non-equilibrium problems at finite temperature. So when I started to kind of think about these problems, I immediately kind of went to look at the literature. And what you see is that the high-energy physicists had understood this very, very early. And they'd been using precisely this technology to understand far-from-equilibrium properties in strongly coupled gauge theories. Okay? So one strong motivation is that if you're interested in heavy ion collisions at, say, the relativistic heavy ion collider, then what you're interested in is somehow the dynamics of some very hot plasma. So in an ideal world, what you would do is you would look for the non-equilibrium dynamics of QCD. Okay, this is clearly a very complicated problem. But on the other hand, you can say, well, do I understand how to compute the dynamics of some related strongly coupled gauge theories? Maybe we can get some insights into heavy ion collisions by thinking about the problems in a slightly different way. Okay. So a lot of the work that was done, very beautiful work by Son and Starinets, for example, on computing the entropy to viscosity ratio using holographic techniques, seems to be in good agreement with experimental data coming out of Rick for measurements on the quark gluon plasma. Okay. So what kind of problems are people interested in? Well, they're interested in all sorts of problems related to thermalization. Basically, you collide these nuclei together at very high energies, you're going to heat the sample up, and you're interested in how does the system thermalize and re-equilibrate? What governs the time scales for this equilibration? Okay. So a lot of the theoretical techniques that were actually being used by the high-energy physicists were, in fact, very similar to techniques that are being used by condensed matter physicists. They think about problems known as quantum quenches, where you imagine preparing your system in a given Hamiltonian and abruptly changing a parameter on the system. You try to drive the system away from its initial ground state, and you ask, how does the system evolve as a function of time? So that's something known as a quantum quench. You prepare a system in a given state and abruptly change the Hamiltonian or change a parameter in the system and ask, how does it evolve? And so a lot of the insights into thermalization was coming from these so-called quantum quenches, where you, for example, change the metric in your higher dimensional space-time very quickly, and you ask, how does the boundary theory respond? Okay? So the idea is that this might give you some insights into thermalization. So on the condensed matter side, we've been trying to now use these techniques to try and understand things that might be interesting experimentally. And to give you a couple of examples, here is a very nice paper by Andrew Green and Julian Sonner, where they were interested in current noise. If you drive a system with a very strong electric field, they were interested in the noise fluctuations in the system. And they managed to demonstrate that you could understand this in terms of Hawking radiation of these black holes. A problem that I worked on with Toby Wiseman and Julian and Ben and Jerome Gauntlet was what happens if you take one of these analogs of a superfluid and you drive it out of equilibrium. What you find, which is actually well known in the high energy literature, is the late time dynamics of these systems are described by so-called quasi-normal modes. They're breathing modes of these black holes. So what it says is that the late time dynamics of your quantum system, you would have a hard time computing this directly as a condensed matter physicist, but what it's saying is the breathing modes of these black holes are somehow encoding in for you information about how you approach the late time thermal behavior following one of these quantum quenches, okay? So the black hole language actually has some impact on your observable time response. So there's also a very nice paper by Will and Subir and company trying to use these quasi-normal modes to perhaps be able to solve some complicated problems in analytic continuation using Monte Carlo. Can you use the pole structure coming out of some of these holographic approaches to guide you how to do the analytic continuation from imaginary time and numerical simulations back to the real axis? Okay. So this is a big problem for simulations, because if you're interested in the real-time response, you have to do this analytic continuation, which might be very uncontrolled. And so more recently, there's very nice papers by Paul Chesler and company relating superfluid turbulence to the possibility of fractal dimensions of the horizons of black holes. Okay. So the main reason for just mentioning these things is that somehow the black hole language and the black hole physics might actually have an impact, a direct impact, on physical observables. So what I want to concentrate on just for the rest of the talk then is one example which tries to illustrate how you can use these holographic techniques to make contact with something very simple that you might imagine measuring in a condensed matter laboratory. So what I mentioned was a lot of interest has gone on in looking at thermalization properties. So the ADS-CFT correspondence is very useful for looking at finite temperature problems. And as a very primitive condensed matter physicist, if you think about thermalization, what you would probably think about is to go back to your elementary textbooks on thermodynamics and just imagine what happens if you take two blocks of matter and glue them together. Okay? What is the resulting heat flow that you get as a result of such a system? Now, obviously, when you look at this usually in relation to thermodynamics problems, you're interested in applying some kind of temperature gradient, perhaps, to your system. I should mention at the outset that what we're going to be interested in here, just for simplicity, is what happens if we join two systems together that are tuned to be at one of these quantum phase transitions. Okay? The reason for doing that is not a limitation of the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's actually because what I'm interested, at least in the first instance, is can we get some simple, universal, non-equilibrium response results? And one place where you might hope to be able to get that is close to a quantum phase transition. Okay? Now, let me just kind of expand upon that a little bit. Normally, when you think about universality and universal response functions, you think very close to equilibrium. So you imagine going through some quantum phase transition. Your correlation length is diverging if it's a second order phase transition. And as a result of that, your system is very insensitive to what happens on small length scales. So you expect to be able to obtain universal results. If you drive a system far from equilibrium, it's far from clear that you can get universal results, because in general, you're going to excite high energy modes in your spectrum. And it's not immediately obvious that there should be any universality whatsoever if you drive a system far from equilibrium. Nonetheless, in these systems that I'm going to describe, there are some universal features which are very robust, which you can compare to exact results coming out of low dimensions. And moreover, you can cross-check them using other techniques of quantum field theory and also hydrodynamics. So what we're going to do then is we're going to look at this problem of taking two very large systems together, join them, and ask what happens, and can we quantify this? So as I said, this is very useful for looking in ADS-CFT, because ADS-CFT is designed to look at non-equilibrium finite temperature problems. But what makes this problem very useful as a simple example is the fact that if you're interested in heat flow, you can understand this problem not from some very fancy starting point. You can consider just simple Einstein's theory of general relativity in this higher-dimensional curved space-time. And this is the standard Einstein-Hilbert action that you would see in any textbook on general relativity, including this cosmological constant, which for these higher-dimensional anti-de Sitter space-times is negative. Okay? But in all other respects, this is precisely what you see in a textbook. And the idea is that the metric of this gravitational theory is dual to the energy momentum tensor in the boundary. So he says, if you want to look at heat flow, I just want to understand the response of this Einstein gravity in this higher dimensional space-time, and I'll follow the rules of the ADS-CFT correspondence to understand how the metric tells me about the energy transport in the boundary. And so it's worth also pointing out that, you know, this is the Einstein centenary. It's 100 years since Einstein wrote down his theory of general relativity. And one thing I should just point out, just for clarity, is that usually when you look at Einstein's theory of general relativity, you're interested in the response of your gravitational space-time to massive objects that you place in this space-time. And so the metric that you usually write down in the Einstein field equations that correspond to the equations of motion of the Einstein-Hilbert action, this energy-momentum tensor is your matter. That's what you place in your space-time. That's what bends space-time. The energy-momentum tensor I'm going to be interested in is not this energy-momentum tensor, okay? The theory I'm considering is pure Einstein gravity, nothing else. There's no matter in the interior of this ADS space-time. And what I'm going to be interested in is the energy-momentum tensor on the boundary as a result of this ADS-CFT correspondence. I'm interested in the heat flow in the lab, and I'm using this gravitational framework as a tool to try and understand that. Okay? So it's worth pointing out that, you know, these Einstein equations are very beautiful and very simple to write down, but actually they mask a lot of complexity. These are actually very complicated, nonlinear coupled partial differential equations. This is part of the reason why, in some of the work that I started out on thinking about these quenches in holographic superfluids, it was absolutely invaluable to work with someone like Toby Wiseman, who's an expert in numerical general relativity, who has a lot of experience in solving these coupled Einstein equations in the presence of black hole solutions and being able to solve the full temporal dynamics of these Einstein equations. Okay. Okay, so what are we interested in? Right? So let me kind of go back into kind of condensed matter language. So there was a very beautiful paper by my colleague Benjamin Doyon and Denny Bernard, where they asked about this problem of heat flow between two infinitely large critical systems, not using ADS-CFT, but just using standard techniques of integrability that apply for one-dimensional critical systems. So this is a one plus one-dimensional quantum system. So what they pointed out is that if these systems are very, very large, okay, they act essentially like their own heat baths. Okay? So we're not driving the system. We're not applying a temperature gradient. We're just taking two isolated systems at two different temperatures, gluing them together, and asking what happens at late times. And the idea is that if these systems are very, very large, then what will emerge is a regime where a steady state energy flow flows across that interface, and you can compute that steady-state energy flow using techniques of integrability. And in fact, they went much further than that. I'm not going to concentrate on those details in this talk, but the main reason for their paper was not just to look at the average energy flow, but also to look at the fluctuations across the interface. Okay? Very often in quantum mechanical systems, we compute expectation values, you compute averages, but actually, from the perspective of energy transport, it's meaningful to ask not just about the average energy flow, but also the fluctuations around that average. So this is something usually referred to as full counting statistics in the condensed matter literature. The idea is that there's fluctuations in the transport across this interface that tell you more information about the quantum properties of this system. So another way to think about this is that you could also imagine this is one system where at time t equals zero, you apply an abrupt temperature profile. So you don't have to imagine gluing them together. It could be just one system. But the other way to think about it is in terms of this quench language. This is what condensed matter physicists would call a local quench. The idea is you're not changing some parameter in the Hamiltonian abruptly across the whole system. You're just gluing the two systems together, so you're locally modifying the system in the vicinity of this interface. Okay? So what did they find? So they found that indeed, if these systems are very, very large, then there's a non-equilibrium steady state that forms. So it's a steady-state energy transfer, but you don't require T left to be very close to T right. And what they predicted is that the energy transport essentially depends on T left squared minus T right squared with a coefficient that is completely universal. It doesn't depend on any microscopic details of your Hamiltonian. It depends on H-bar, Boltzmann's constant. This parameter C is the so-called central charge. It describes the number of effective degrees of freedom in your 1D critical system. Okay, so that would, for example, enter into the prefactor of the specific heat capacity. So the Ising model, for example, in 1 plus 1 dimensions has C equals 1/2. A Heisenberg chain in the gapless regime would have C equals 1. So this is a property of your system, but it doesn't depend on the microscopic details. It just depends on the universality class. So this is an example of a universal result out of equilibrium. And a simple physical way to think about this is that you remember from kind of kindergarten thermodynamics that black body radiation, the energy density goes as T to the 4. So in another way to think about that T to the 4 dependence is that it's actually T to the D plus 1. And usually the space-time dimension is 4, so it's T to the 4. Here we're in 1 plus 1 dimension, and so you can regard this result as being that you have Stefan Boltzmann radiation coming from these two bodies. It's passing through each other, and essentially your heat flow is the difference of T left squared minus T right squared. Okay? If I look at this from a slightly different perspective, if I instead decompose this T left squared minus T right squared into the sum and the difference of T left and T right, okay, and just factorize this quadratic expression, you can also regard it as something that's proportional to T left plus T right, or essentially the average temperature, times the difference of those temperatures. So if you do that, okay, you can look at what this energy current looks like. It's some quantity multiplied by the difference of temperatures. And this quantity that sits in front is the central charge, this thing that counts the number of degrees of freedom of your critical system, times a fundamental unit of thermal conductance. And so this is what's known as the quantum of thermal conductance. I told you in the beginning that there is a well-defined quantum of charge conductance, E squared upon H. There's a very similar quantity you can write down for thermal conductance. The main difference is that not only does it depend on fundamental constants such as Boltzmann's constant and Planck's constant, it also depends on the temperature. Okay, so it's not a constant in the same sense. But on the other hand, you're asking about transport of heat, so it should depend on the temperature. Okay, so in particular, this quantum of thermal conductance can actually be measured. It has been measured quite a long time ago in nanostructures. So what I'm showing you here is some experimental data. You don't need all the details. Essentially, this is a little central island that they're heating up. And they have some nano-fabricated leads that are suspended, and there's four little leads connected to this island. And those little leads have phonons, they have vibrational degrees of freedom, and they can conduct heat. And essentially, you can count how many vibrational degrees of freedom you have. It turns out that you have four vibrational degrees of freedom per wire. And so if you have four of these wires joined to this terminal, you expect that at very low temperatures, your conductance, if you're in a quantum regime, is 16 times the fundamental unit of this conductance quantum. And this saturation is showing precisely the thermal conductance divided by 16 G naught. And indeed, you see that it saturates at this quantum value. Okay, so this coefficient is something that's genuinely experimentally measurable in the lab. Now, what you can also do is you can also, instead of doing real experiments, you can also do numerical experiments. And very shortly after Benjamin's work, there was some very nice work done in the group of Joel Moore at Berkeley, where they use so-called time-dependent DMRG to try and understand this far-from-equilibrium energy transport problem numerically. Okay? And this is quite important because what we would like to be able to do is have other techniques for understanding some of these strongly correlated problems, both in and out of equilibrium. And so these numerical approaches have been very successful in looking at problems in equilibrium. So actually, this is recent work because it's actually quite a challenge to look at the time-dependent problems. And what I'm going to try and argue is that, in a sense, what we've managed to do is to derive some similar analogous results in higher dimensions for which you would be hard-pressed using conventional techniques to be able to calculate in other ways. And so at the moment, there are no, to the best of my knowledge, numerical techniques that could understand the non-equilibrium dynamics of a 2 plus 1D quantum system. But actually, if advances in quantum information and entanglement carry on at the rate they are doing, then it could well be that some of these barriers will be overcome very shortly, because actually these numerical techniques rely on the fact that they're in some sense trying to get rid of the entanglement of the system and just concentrate on those degrees of freedom that are actually relevant. Okay? So in a sense, these results should hopefully be benchmarks for future numerical experiments. So what are we going to do? So we said we're going to try and look at this using this ADS-CFT correspondence. What we'd like to do is to try and take two black holes at two different temperatures and join them together and ask how this evolves as a function of time in the Einstein equation. This is not what we set up. Okay? The reason is it can be done, and actually it has been done, but what we do here is we actually rather concentrate on the behavior in the vicinity of the interface. Why? Because if these are critical systems and you just join them together, the idea is that the transport in this system ought to be ballistic, that what should happen is that in the vicinity of this interface, there will be left and right moving waves that propagate out. The information is going to be communicated from time t equals zero as a function of time. The disturbance will go out from this interface. And what we're going to try and describe is this steady state region, which you can convince yourself is spatially homogeneous. And we have some extra evidence for this as well. Okay, essentially, the fact that we're not applying a temperature gradient and this is ballistic transport implies that the emergent steady state regime should be spatially homogeneous. So what it says is, I'm going to be interested in spatially homogeneous regions emerging in this boundary theory. Okay, and so if you look at this, from the perspective of the Einstein equations, it turns out that the only way you can get a steady state energy flow on the boundary is to run past a black hole. Okay? So simply put, you have this black hole, it's at some finite temperature, you run past it, you will get an energy flow. Okay? Now in truth, I could have guessed that without a black hole in the first place. Right? If you just have a system with a finite energy density and you run past it, you're going to get an energy current. But what's interesting is the Einstein equations are telling us that this is the unique way to do that, okay? That you have to run past a thermal state. So put differently, what this picture is telling us is that when we join these two systems together, at T left and T right, there's an emergent steady state region which should be equivalent to running past a thermal state at one temperature. So there's two questions. What's that temperature, and how fast do you have to run past the system in order to see that indeed the two things line up? And I should say, just to be very clear at the outset, if all I was interested in was the average energy current, this wouldn't be a big deal. But the claim is going to be, not only can you get the average energy current, you can get the entire distribution of fluctuations by running past a thermal state if you identify the correct temperature and you run at the correct speed. Okay? So how do you see this? Well, what you do is you can go through this ADS-CFT correspondence. You can look at these solutions of the Einstein equations which correspond to running past a black hole. So theta is your boost parameter. And you can read off the energy momentum tensor from this metric. Okay? If you do that, what do you find? You find the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. Okay? And in many respects, this should actually be very clear. What it says is we have this quantum critical system. It's at a finite temperature. In some sense, it's some interacting quantum fluid. What do I find? I find my energy momentum tensor is the stress tensor of a perfect fluid, something that you could have maybe guessed by just thinking about relativistic hydrodynamics. The reason I wanted to go through this approach using ADS-CFT, not using hydrodynamics, is that if you go through the full correspondence, the coefficient that stands in front of this is not arbitrary, it's computable. And in fact, if you compute it, it turns out to play the same role as the central charge. Okay? So in the same way that in the 1D result we had this universal result with a prefactor that could be computed and related to the central charge, you get out the same result from starting from the Einstein equations in one higher dimension. And the main thing you then have to understand is, how did I pick the temperature? Well, it turns out that this temperature of the perfect conformal fluid is equal to the square root of T left and T right. Okay? One way to see this is very crudely. If you imagine running past a black hole, you can imagine that the radiation in front of you is Doppler shifted one way, the radiation behind you is Doppler shifted the other way. In a sense, these are a little bit like Lorentz transformations of temperature, okay? And it's a little bit tricky to talk about Lorentz transformations of temperature, but what I'm saying is that there is an emergent left and right temperature which are related to your boost of the background temperature. And so if you multiply these two expressions together, you see that you should run past a thermal state at this temperature square root of T left and T right. And so if people remember from kind of thermodynamics textbooks, square root of T left and T right is the temperature at which two bodies would reach thermal equilibrium if you join them by a reversible Carnot engine. Okay? So that's not what we're doing here, but what it suggests is that somehow behind this identification is some deep link to thermodynamics. Okay? So how are we going to generalize this to higher D? Okay? That was the main reason for looking at this problem, because in higher D we don't have any other kind of techniques. We can't use methods of integrability to understand this energy flow. So what you can do is you can do something similar, and you can say, well, look, let me take two blocks of material with some transverse direction going into the screen. We imagine that we have some disturbances that propagate out from this interface when we join them together. Generically, they could and do have different propagation speeds, U left and U right. And so what you want to ask then is you want to ask about something like energy momentum conservation across these shock fronts, okay, in a fluid dynamics picture. Basically, energy and momentum are going to be conserved. We expect this energy and momentum tensor to be conserved. And so if you do that, and you apply energy momentum conservation across those shock fronts, it turns out that you can constrain the form of the steady state energy momentum tensor. Okay? So if you remember, what I said is the internal energy density goes as T to the D plus 1 for Stefan Boltzmann radiation. This is T left to the D plus 1 minus T right to the D plus 1, but it's divided by these non-trivial velocities, U left plus U right, which is essentially related to the volume of this interface as these wavefronts propagate outwards, okay? So it's not quite just the simple difference of these two temperatures. It's a little bit more complicated, but you can get this by thinking about energy momentum conservation across these shock fronts. And so the idea is that if you now try and compare this to this boosted thermal state, it turns out that again, you find that the intermediate region corresponds to a thermal state at this temperature square root of T left and T right, and there's a well-defined boost velocity that you have to run past your system at. And so the question is, does this have any relevance? Can you see this? So what we're showing here is some simulations of what is called conformal hydrodynamics. It just says, take my energy momentum tensor T mu nu. Let's treat it as a problem in fluid mechanics. Let's apply a temperature T left and T right. And let's, for simplicity, just imagine it's some smooth profile that interpolates between T left and T right. And monitor how the steady state forms. And so what we're showing is that if you look at how the steady state forms, okay, so for simplicity, we're assuming that it's homogeneous in these transverse directions. So these are simulations done in 2+1 dimensions. What you see is that the steady state region grows with characteristic velocities, and the red lines are the theoretical predictions. The red line over here is the prediction for what the energy density should be in the steady state. So what it says is that from this fluid dynamics picture, we can see that indeed this corresponds to essentially running past a thermal state. And in particular, if you look at very big asymmetries between these left and right reservoirs, then these propagation speeds are actually very different, but they nonetheless match precisely the theoretical predictions. Okay? So just to summarize, what we've done is we've taken some insights from the solutions of the Einstein equations. We've compared them to exact results in 1+1 dimensions and demonstrate that they agree precisely. That not only the average energy flow, but also the full spectrum of fluctuations can be computed across this interface. And that if you do numerical simulations of hydrodynamics, again, you see this correspondence to this boosted thermal state at this temperature square root of T left and T right. Okay? So one of the things we're now trying to work on is to try and generalize this not just to energy transport, but also to charge transport, okay? So it's a lot of interest in trying to understand the fluctuations in currents and in current noise. And so just to kind of conclude, it's kind of nice as a condensed matter theorist that 100 years after the advent of general relativity, Einstein's equations still have something to tell us, not just about the large-scale structure of space-time, but actually about things that are potentially measurable in the lab, okay, and could actually help guide both numerical and analytical work in condensed matter physics. So I think I will finish there.
So, questions?
Thank you. Behind Einstein's equation, there is this principle of equivalence. So, is there any condensed matter principle that we have not realized so far?
It's a good question, actually. I don't know. So you mean kind of equivalence between gravitational and inertial mass, and does that have any correspondence in the boundary theory? It's a good question. I don't actually know. It's funny, actually. At the time I was kind of thinking about this problem, I remember chatting to Duncan Haldane about potential analogies with gravitational problems. And for example, if you have a body that's accelerating, okay, you get the so-called Unruh effect. And so one of the thoughts is that maybe there was some analogy to the Unruh effect. In this case, I couldn't quite see it, because actually the steady state that we form is moving at a constant velocity. So whether or not there was any room for kind of behavior under acceleration, I don't know. So it's a good question. So it could well be that there are some analogies to be had. I mean, what I can say is from looking at some of these problems, I mean, you know, if you take this dictionary seriously, and you say, I'm interested in this gravitational problem, just turn the handle and compute things. Can I make sense of those observables as a condensed matter physicist? It turns out you can, okay? So at least if you ask sufficiently simple questions. And so it's a good question. Maybe there is
something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So to what extent do the results you just showed us depend on sitting on a critical point, or are they?
It's a good question. So in the first instance, they depend in the sense that I use this kind of ADS-CFT correspondence as it is. But actually, the ADS-CFT correspondence you normally refer to as gauge gravity duality to emphasize that it's not just critical points you can deal with. So if you took the intuition that you glean from this approach, you've got different ways of attacking the problem. One is, you say, well, you know, thanks very much, Einstein. You gave us a hint as to what to do. Now we know what to do. We're going to ignore you, and we're just going to do fluid dynamics. If you do fluid dynamics, you could just take an equation of state as you please, and it doesn't have to be conformal in the sense that it doesn't have to depend on t to the d plus 1. You could take any equation of state you want and do fluid hydrodynamics. Okay? And so I think Rob Myers, with one of his students, is actually looking at precisely that. You could also look at deformations of this ADS-CFT correspondence to add other perturbations to the interior and perhaps move away from criticality and again see whether or not you could solve the Einstein equations and see which steady state you form. Okay.
So you said briefly that the solutions that you had here were the same thing you'd get from the Carnot engine. Or you made the analogy square root TLTR was the same temperature.
Yes.
Does this in some way mean that this hydrodynamics is not generating any entropy?
So first of all, we don't actually have a proof to see where this correspondence comes from, actually. So what I didn't talk about is you can actually ask about the solutions to these Rankine-Huguenot equations. And it turns out that in general, from a theoretical perspective, there's more solutions you could write down. You could imagine setting up initial conditions where you don't just get two shocks, you got three shocks, four shocks, et cetera, et cetera. What we see is in the numerics, we always seem to find two shock solutions, so they're the natural physical solutions. But what you can ask is you can ask about trying to kind of maximize kind of entropy production in these states, okay, look for extrema, and it turns out that the two shock solutions somehow are extrema in the sense of minimization, over the space of solutions. So what it suggests is that there is some related minimization or thermodynamic principle behind the selection of these two shock solutions, which is compatible and consistent with the appearance of this square root and T left and T right, okay? But I don't have a very good physical picture for how this comes about. Because if you just take two bodies at two temperatures, T left and T right, they equilibrate not at the square root of T left and T right, they equilibrate at the average, okay? If you connect them via a reversible cycle and extract the maximum amount of work, then they reach a temperature square root of T left and T right. So one possible interpretation is what you're doing in this setup is you're somehow extracting that work and converting it into the flow between these reservoirs, okay? So somehow, behind all of this technology is some connection to thermodynamics that we've not been able to pin down, okay? But there's some hints that there are some minimization principles.
So I have two questions. First one being, if you set, for example, T left to zero, exactly, you just clarified that.
No, that's confusing, and actually I don't have a very good understanding of that. So that turns out to be something that's actually difficult to do in hydro. It's also very strange from the perspective of the identification of the temperatures, right? Because one is T left e to the theta, the other is T right e to the minus theta. So in that limit, to set one to zero, you have to kind of boost the other one to infinity, okay? So I think the other way of looking at it is it's a slightly kind of pathological case because you have one bath at zero temperature, whatever that means, and you have another system at a finite temperature, and it's probably kind of just injecting energy into one situation. So somehow, at least in the framework we've discussed, it's not really kind of set up to deal with that particular point in parameter space. Okay, and I don't have a qualitative feel for why that should be the case. Okay, but what I can say is that if you look at hydrodynamics with any temperature you want, just some small temperatures, some large temperature difference, then the resulting energy flow in the steady state. I mean, here I talked about the energy current, but you can also look at the energy density. All of these things match precisely what you would expect from boosting past this thermal state. Okay, so I don't know what happens if one of the baths is at absolute zero.
So I was asking because I was curious about what happens if instead of having thermal ensembles, you have two pure quantum states, but which have a finite energy density. So can you generalize this to other ensembles or other pure states?
A good question, actually. I mean, the thing is that within the framework of the ADS-CFT correspondence, actually, in a sense, you're probably naturally predisposed to look at finite temperature systems. I mean, in principle, you could look at a system that didn't have a black hole in the interior, okay? So perhaps that would be one starting point, okay? So I don't know whether actually that would correspond to precisely what you're asking, okay? So it's just that very often in these non-equilibrium settings through gravity, at least your end point will be some thermal state. You'll inject some energy into the system, you'll form a black hole, so you're usually dealing with some thermal state on the boundary, okay? Whether or not it's possible to actually implement precisely zero temperature, I'm not sure, okay? Maybe you can ask about it in hydrodynamics, but even then I'm not entirely sure that you can treat that case very reliably.
Next question.
Your review of the ADS-CFT made me think of this very general question, not specifically related to your work, but apparently there are now systems where involving localization, Anderson-type localization, which do not ever reach thermal equilibrium.
Yeah, you're talking about many-body localized phases.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So I actually.
Is there any? Go on.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Sorry. You carry on with your question. Yeah.
This is somewhat at variance with the kind of idea we have about black hole no-hair theorems and settling down to, and always settling down to equilibrium. So does it mean that ADS-CFT doesn't apply, or is there something we're missing about the bulk, or can you comment at all on that?
Yeah, so when you talk about Anderson localization, I mean, normally you're thinking about problems in the presence of some disorder, okay, and some typically non-interacting problem in the presence of disorder. Here, given the fact that in this holographic setup you have very strongly interacting CFTs, If you add disorder to them, I think the natural analog is in terms of these many body localized phases, okay? And so the question is, can you implement disorder into these holographic systems and still turn the machinery, okay?
Yes.
So let me give you some examples where people have tried to look at things like that, okay? So if you do a thermal quench, okay, to a critical point, okay, you might imagine something like Kibble's Urek scaling, where you kind of form some little defects in some domains. Okay? Holographically, one way you can take this into account is you imagine, instead of doing solutions of the Einstein equations, you can imagine averaging over an ensemble of Einstein equations. And so if you do that, you can see Kibble's Urek scaling. So that was something that Julian Sonner did in collaboration with Zurek himself. There was also Antonio Scardiccio in ICCP did a similar thing for disordered systems, where you ensemble average over different realizations of the Einstein equations corresponding to different parameters. And so I think it should be possible to make contact with these many-body localized phases. And if you can understand the dynamics of the boundary theory, in principle, you should be able to see that maybe they don't equilibrate. I mean, actually, let me just comment on one thing that's related to that. One of the original problems I wanted to look at was something in the condensed matter literature known as GGE. It's called the generalized Gibbs ensemble. So what it says is if you do a quench in an integrable model is a clean system, no disorder. It's got an infinite number of conservation laws. What you expect is that at late times, all of these conservation laws play a role in your dynamics. On the other hand, if I ask my string theory colleagues what's going to happen, they tell me it thermalizes. So if you take an example in ADS3 that has a 1 plus 1D boundary, the question is, what would be the late time density matrix governing that system? Do all the conservation laws appear? And does that in some way evade thermalization? So the indications from condensed matter is that that should happen. If I look at what happens in this example, it turns out there's a kind of get-out clause that actually, in the 1D case, let me just show it you. This is the density matrix that describes all of those fluctuations in that system. So I said it was a boosted thermal state. So the density matrix is not just Boltzmann. It's a boosted version of Boltzmann. And if you do a Lorentz boost, you mix in the momentum with the energy. And so if you set the temperature to be square root of T left, T right, it turns out this is the exact density matrix you get from a 1 plus 1D analysis of that thermal setup. So this is an example of something that's GGE-like in that you're not thermalizing, you have not only the energy, you have this extra conserved quantity. And so in a 1D system, naively, you would imagine all of these conserved quantities to appear. It's a little bit strange that actually in the thermal problem, they don't, okay? But we know of examples where they do. So in principle, you have ensembles where there could be other conserved quantities appearing in the exponent. And so in black hole language, whether you should regard this as absence of thermalization or not is a slightly separate issue. I mean, in this case, it's simple. It's actually running past a thermal ensemble.
Well, presumably it settles down to some steady state. It's just characterized by many temperature-like parameters.
That's exactly the point.
Instead of single one.
That's precisely the point. So there's been a lot of work in condensed matter physics where you can see that in non-equilibrium dynamics of integrable low-D systems, you need an infinite number of temperatures to describe their late-time behavior.
Yeah. Oh, so then it wouldn't be as dramatically different from thermal equilibrium as it sounds. If that were the real story for the condensed matter system.
Well, so what I would say is, I mean, it's a question of also maybe interpretation and taste, right? I mean, if you look at kind of thermodynamics, you know, you usually add some Lagrange multiplier. You could have a chemical potential, so you'd have mu times n. So you usually couple to conserved quantities in the exponent. So I would say whether you call this Gibbs or generalized Gibbs is maybe a question.
But are you saying that the disorder is somehow equivalent to having an infinite number of conserved quantities? Or
So what is known is that in some of these regimes of the disordered problems that show absence of ergodicity in these many-body localized phases, they are described by integrable models, clean integrable models. So somehow there's a relationship between the proliferation of conservation laws and the strange behavior in these interacting disordered systems.
Are there any more questions? Okay, then let's thank you again.